From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. You may remember the poster, Frank Zappa sitting naked on a toilet. That Who Cares attitude helped make Zappa a cult figure, even though he thought the record companies labeled his music as no commercial potential. On today's Fresh Air, Frank Zappa talks about rock, censorship, and being weird. Also today, I speak with poet and novelist Dennis Cooper, whose brutal sexual imagery is influenced by De Sade. Cooper says he intends to be disturbing, but not shocking. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers some of the musicians who were mixing country and rock and roll at the same time Elvis was becoming big. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Good Times, the new memoir from columnist Russell Baker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In 1964, Frank Zappa named his band The Mothers. But a couple of years later, when they recorded their first album, Freak Out, Zappa's record company, MGM, was convinced that no DJ would play a band with that name. So Zappa changed it to The Mothers of Invention. But as Zappa says, when it came to getting airplay, their name was the least of their problems. Their music, sexual allusions, avant-garde influences, and noisy anti-everything attitudes were more of an obstacle. Over the last 20 years, Zappa has written satirical rock songs, jazz fusion, and compositions influenced by classical avant-gardists like Edgar Varèse and Karlheinz Stockhausen. Some people think of him as rock's eccentric genius, but others have criticized him for being sexist, adolescent, and condescending to rock music and its listeners. Zappa has had several encounters with censorship. A couple of years ago, he became one of the leading opponents of the parents' group which advocated a record rating system to alert parents to sexually explicit rock lyrics. Zappa had a hit in 1982 with the song Valley Girl, which featured his daughter, Moon Unit, doing a parody of the Valley lingo. Many of Zappa's records have recently been reissued on Ryko Disc, and he has a new book about his life called The Real Frank Zappa Book. I asked Frank Zappa what kind of music he was writing before he started the Mothers of Invention.
Well, I started off writing chamber music and small orchestral pieces. And I didn't write a rock and roll song until I was about 21.
But you played in lounge bands too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's not music.
What is it?
Well, it's a very low form of entertainment. I'll give you an example of lounge band repertoire. We were working at a place called Tommy Sandy's Club Sahara in San Bernardino. And we were playing things like the Anniversary Waltz, Happy Birthday, and we were allowed to play two twist numbers per night.
Well, given the kind of anarchic and rebellious spirit that you've had throughout your career, did you do anything unpredictable when you were playing in lounges? Or did you just put up with the rules and play those two twists a night and go into Happy Birthday?
Well, it wasn't my band, so I was hired to be the guitar player, and I sat on a stool, wore a white dinner jacket and a bow tie, and shiny black shoes, and sat there and played the chord changes to songs that I detested.
Now, how did you form your own band, The Mothers of Invention?
Well, once upon a time, I got a phone call from a guy that I'd been doing some recording with, and he said he had just had an argument with a guitar player in this band that he was working with. In fact, he had punched him out, and they needed a substitute guitar player for a weekend job, and I went to play with him at this club called The Broadside in Pomona. And I had some laughs, and I liked the band, and I liked the drummer, and I said, well, why don't we learn some original material, because that was, we were basically just playing In the Midnight Hour and that kind of dance music of the period, and suggested we learn some original material and try and get a record contract. The leader of that band was a guy named Davey Coronado, the sax player. And he wisely advised that if we were to learn original material, we would never be employed again. Well, everybody in the other guys in the band wanted to do it, and Davey didn't, so he quit. And he was right. As soon as we started playing original material, we got fired every place.
But you got a record contract.
Yeah, by accident.
What was the accident?
The guy who finally came to see us playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles had other things on his mind, and he came in and he saw only one song that we played, and based on this one song, thought that he was signing a white blues band.
He made a big mistake, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let me play something from the very first album that you recorded. The album's called Freak Out, and let's listen to an excerpt of it. My guest is Frank Zappa.
It can't happen here. It can't happen here. I'm telling you, my dear, that it can't happen here. Because I've been checking it out, baby. I checked it out a couple of times. And I'm telling you, it can't happen here. Oh, darling, it's important that you believe me, bop, 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 that it can't happen here. Who could imagine that they would freak out somewhere in Kansas?
Kansas.
Could imagine that they would freak out in Minnesota. Could imagine.
From the album Freak Out, Frank Zappa is my guest. Would it be stretching a point to say that what we just heard was influenced in part by the avant-garde classical music you'd been listening to?
I would say that that's probably a direct linear descendant of Anagramma by Mauricio Coggle.
Which is?
That's a contemporary musical composition that uses that kind of spoken word permutation, perversion, however you want to call it.
Do you want to tell the story about buying your first Edgar Varèse record?
Well, if you want, sure.
Yeah, right. It's not whether you want to, it's when I want to. Right?
Okay. Well, once upon a time, I saw an article in Look magazine that was saying what a wonderful man Sam Goody was. Sam Goody was described in this article as being a genius of merchandising because he could sell any kind of a record. And as an example of his merchandising genius, they referred to an album called Ionizations. That wasn't really the name of the album. That was a print mistake in the article. And it described this album as having the ugliest music in the world. It had all drums. It was dissonant. It was so horrible, but yet Sam Goody was able to sell some of these things. And based on the description of this album, I thought, this is the music for me. And I went looking for it in this little town that I was living in, and nobody had it. And then one day, by accident, I ran into it in a bin of demonstration records in a hi-fi store in a small town in Southern California called La Mesa. And the guy had been using it to demonstrate hi-fis, and apparently, whenever he put it on, he didn't make the sale, so he was willing to sell it rather cheaply, and I bought it. And I was delighted. I'd listened to it. It was the first album I owned, and I used to listen to it all the time. The real name of the album was The Complete Works of Edgar Varèse, Volume 1, and it was on a label called EMS, which stands for Elaine Music Store, and the record number was 401.
You were telling us that the record executive who signed you thought he was getting a white blues band.
Yeah.
What was his reaction when he heard your album Freak Out?
Well, it wasn't that he had a reaction when he heard the album, because he was also the producer of the first album. His name was Tom Wilson. And on the day of the first recording session, I think the first tune that we did was Anyway the Wind Blows, and that was kind of normal, straightforward, 1960, just a little song. And that was okay. And then we did Who Are the Brain Police, and immediately this very strange expression came over his face because I could see him through the control room window. And he was on the phone right away to New York, probably trying to explain in advance, cover himself for what he had unleashed. Because he didn't know. He was a busy executive. There was no way for him to know what was really going to be in the Freak Out album. He'd left it up to me to do all the preparations in Los Angeles, book the studio time, and prepare everything while he was flying back and forth from New York to Hollywood. And then on that day, he got the big surprise.
And what happened?
Well, he stood behind us. You know, he fought very hard to get MGM, which was the record company that released the thing, to support it and promote it. And they tried, I suppose, in their own mysterious way to help us have a hit record, but it was kind of it was going against the grain of the company, let's put it that way.
My guest is Frank Zappa, and he's written a new memoir called The Real Frank Zappa Book. In your memoir, you describe the Mothers of Invention as ugly guys with long hair and weird clothes, just what the entertainment world needed. Did you think of yourself as ugly?
Yep. Still do.
Did that affect you a lot when you were growing up? I mean, were you self-conscious about the way you looked?
Well, I think that most young kids are self-conscious about the way they look, but, you know, if you dwell on that for the rest of your life, it gets in your way. You know, you come to grips with it, and there you go.
Well, did the whole kind of freak period help you in that respect? Because everybody was looking really weird. I mean, it was fun to look weird. It was a style to look weird.
Well, looking weird is one thing. Looking ugly is something else.
Mm-hmm. So you thought you were beyond weird?
Well, I think I had the best of both worlds.
Remember the poster of you sitting on a toilet?
Why, of course I do.
Yes. Yeah, I figured you'd remember it. Well, why did you do that?
Well, it wasn't designed to be a poster. That picture was taken when we did our first tour to England. There was a underground newspaper there called the International Times. And the photographer that was sent over to the hotel to take pictures for this story that they were doing said, hey, why don't you just sit on the toilet? I said, sure, fine. So I did. And the next thing you know, the photographer had taken the photograph and he had made a poster out of it and he was selling it and he was making money from it in England. There's a difference in the copyright laws over there, apparently, that if a photographer takes your picture there, he owns the rights to your image and likeness and he can profit from it. And that's not the way it is in the U.S.
So were you angry with him for doing this?
Well, sure. And then because in those days there wasn't very much control over copyright matters, his poster was then bootlegged by somebody in Holland and then bootlegged again by somebody else in Germany. So the next thing I know, there was pictures of me sitting on the toilet all over the world, which was making somebody a bunch of money, but it wasn't me. In fact, if people know my name or know my likeness, more of them know about me from that poster than have ever heard an album.
Hmm. Well, if you had made the money on it and if you had been consulted on it and everything was legit, would you have still objected to the poster? Did you like the poster? Let's leave the money question aside here.
Oh, the poster didn't bother me. If somebody wants to look at me sitting on the toilet, have at it. And if somebody wants to pay for the privilege, why, sure.
Okay. You've done a lot of rock and roll satires over the years, and I want to play one of them. And this is from an album that you did under the name of Reuben and the Jets. First of all, why did you take on a different name to do this?
Well, this was a concept album. It was, here's the concept. Stravinsky went through a period where he was doing neoclassic music, and the idea was to take all the norms and conventions of the classical music and rearrange the norms in order to create some other kind of music. So what I did was take the norms and common practices of doo-wop music and twist them around to make another kind of music. And then enhance this with this imaginary, let's call it, scientific doo-wop group, which we would call Reuben and the Jets.
Okay, well, from that Reuben and the Jets album, this is Later That Night.
You surely must be trying to break this heart of mine. I thought you knew I loved you and we'd share a love so fine. But later that night, padlock on my door, my clothes out on the street, don't want my love no more. And I cry,
voice is pretty deep on that one.
Well, it's not that deep.
Did you like doo-wop?
Oh, yeah. Really liked it.
You did?
Yeah.
Because I can't tell, listening from the records, whether you're parroting out of affection or dislike.
No, I have a big collection of doo-wop records. I like them.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were born in, I think, 1940?
Yeah.
So you were in your teens by the time rock and roll was hitting the charts.
Yeah, I watched it be invented. Mm-hmm. Then I watched it rot away before my very eyes.
Okay, let's compare reactions. What were the first things that you saw being invented that you liked a lot in rock and roll?
In the earliest days, it wasn't called rock and roll. I think they started off calling it race music, and then it became called rhythm and blues. And then when white people figured out they could make money from this, it became rock and roll. And in the early days, the people who were singing those songs about their girlfriends actually believed in them. These were kids singing about things that were part of their lifestyle, and these songs were consumed by other kids, so there was a certain realism to it that I think is kind of lacking in a lot of the product that's in the market today.
Well, yeah, it's the believed in it part that I really like. There's a lot of songs, even with really dumb lyrics, where the singer really believes in it and is pouring their heart into it, and it's like great stuff.
That was the essence of what rock and roll was all about. It had a credibility that How Much Is That Doggy in the Window didn't have. You see, there was other types of music that were available during that period of time.
But musically, I feel like that's something you've really deprived yourself of, because lyrically, like all the songs that you've done, and I don't mean your instrumental compositions, but the songs that you've done are almost all parodies where you're mocking conventions and never kind of pouring your heart out, you know? And I wonder why.
Well, first of all, there's no need for anyone to understand what lives in my heart, if in fact such an organ exists. Secondly, in contemporary terms, I think that it is a despicable thing to do, to earn your living by sharing your personal inner turmoil with somebody else for money. I don't like those kinds of singer-songwriter types who are always weeping about the tragedy in their life. I mean, why? Who needs it? Everybody else has got theirs.
Well, I mean, you don't have to be whining to sing a good ballad.
Well, yeah, but usually they are.
Uh-huh.
That's the problem.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music and your life. But first, we're going to take a short break. And composer and
comedian.
Guitarist, yeah, and satirist Frank Zappa is my guest. And he's written a new book called The Real Frank Zappa Book. More after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Frank Zappa is my guest. Why did you disband your first band, The Mothers of Invention?
Combination of economic factors and the idea that in order for the band to develop, it had to rehearse. And there was not much of an incentive for these guys to grow musically. To bring them to a rehearsal place and make them pay attention for a few hours was a major psychological undertaking.
Why?
Why? Because musicians, I think this is probably a genetic thing, they're basically pretty lazy. They like to play music, but they don't really like to work at it too much.
So you gave up the Mothers and started forming different bands for different pieces and different records that you were doing.
Well, that original group of Mothers that were for the first 5 years already had many changes in personnel.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't anything new that I was changing guys. I think there have been over 100 different musicians in the band through the years.
You knew the GTOs, the Girls Together Outrageously, which is one of the more famous group of groupies. Can I ask you what your you've been married since 1967, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when there were a lot of groupies hanging around your door, did you want to take advantage of that?
What do you mean, did I want to take advantage of that?
Well, what I mean is, did you like to have sex with groupies, or did you kind of
Well, I like to have sex, but I'm not particularly fond of having sex with groupies because generally a person who is a groupie has other priorities rather than sex in mind. It's more of, you know, kind of a gunslinger mentality, and that's something I don't want to participate in.
So you stayed away from that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I want to play one of the instrumental, one of your best-known compositions, and this is Peaches on Regalia from the Hot Rats album, and this is one of the many records of Frank Zappa's that have recently been reissued on the Ryko disc label. Talk to me about what you were going through musically when you wrote this, what you'd been listening to then, and what you were trying to put into the compositions you were writing.
Well, Peaches and Regalia started off as a set of chords that were scribbled on a piece of paper, and these chords were played by a four-piece group just as a backing track. And after the backing track was constructed, the original backing track was in three sections, a front, a long middle section, which contained a blues violin solo, and then a recapitulation at the end. And these were recorded in three chunks, and the intention was to edit these chunks together to make a long piece, which would have been 12 or 14 minutes. And the middle part was okay, but it seemed at the end of the day that it didn't fit with the rest of it. So Peaches and Regalia was built in layers. It was one of the first major overdubbing projects that I got into, and it was the first album that I made using a 16-track recorder, which was a brand new piece of technology at that time. And it was just all the melodic material in it was written in the studio, just pretty much a line at a time, and then either I would play the extra part or Ian Underwood would overdub the extra part. So it was, let's call it an organic composition. It wasn't something where I would sit down and write it all out and walk in with a score.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear the opening of it. This is Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa's Hot Rats album, that's an excerpt of his composition, Peaches on Regalia. You've recently more or less given up the guitar, I understand?
Between tours, I never play it.
Uh-huh. And instead you work with a synclavier.
That's right.
Which is a synthesizer. Why don't you play more guitar?
There's no incentive to do it. So why bother?
You mean no incentive performance-wise or no incentive just when you're sitting home?
Well, if you're doing a tour, you don't want to just be standing there on stage, so you better do something, so then you play the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not touring, then I'm not a guitar fetishist. I don't sit around and piddle with a thing for hours on end and just sort of express myself. I don't have that feeling.
Mm-hmm. You don't leave your house very much from what I've heard about you, that you really just stay home most of the time and play music, hang out with your family. You don't drive.
That's right.
Why? It seems like an unnecessarily confined life. Obviously, it seems to be the one you want, but why isolate yourself like that?
Well, why go out? I mean, I'm out now. I'm promoting a book. I've got, I'm going to spend this week talking and talking and talking and shaking hands with people and doing all that kind of stuff. So when it's over, this particular job will be done, and then I can go back and do other things that I would prefer to do, like sit around and write music or work with a synclavier or work on other things.
Do you go to concerts or movies?
No. I can watch films on television or videotape, but I hate to go to the movies.
Is that because you're recognized there?
No, I don't mind being recognized. I think most of the people that I run into on the street are very friendly, and I don't have any problem with them. I just shake hands with them, and if they want an autograph, I give it to them.
Then what do you hate about going to the movies?
Well, just to spend the time to sit in a room with people chewing on popcorn, looking at that big thing on the screen. I said, why? Why pay money to do that? It's not entertaining to me.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, you became very active in the fight against the Parents Music Resource Group proposals to put labels on albums if there was sexually explicit material in the lyrics. And it was interesting when you went to when you jumped in that fray, you put on a suit and were really kind of very straightforward spokesperson on behalf of the side against labeling these lyrics. And I was wondering what went into your choosing the kind of effect you wanted to make. I mean, you weren't being the bad boy. You weren't being theatrical. Do you know what I mean? You were really being like responsible spokesperson.
Well, what are you supposed to do? I mean, I basically thought of those women as a bunch of deranged lunatics and making proposals that would, in the long run, result in the diminishment of personal freedom in the United States if all the proposals were adopted. And so I had to say something about it. You know, these were things which would have, if it turned into legislation, affect my life, affect the life of my family, and mm-hmm. I didn't see anybody else going out there with a broomstick to chase them, so I did it.
As a father, have you drawn any, when your children were younger, did you draw any limits on their television watching or music listening or the films that they could go to?
No. None at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there are any things that you have been musically held back from doing because of the lack of commercial potential in it, or do you feel that you've done what you've wanted to do no matter what?
Well, I continue to do what I like to do, but whether or not anybody ever hears it is a matter of access to airtime.
Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of things that you're doing at home now that you think most of us probably won't get to hear because it won't get recorded?
Oh, it'll get recorded, but whether or not you will ever find the record in a store or ever hear the record played on the air, that's the question. The material does exist, but whether anybody gets to consume it is a matter of distribution, and it's also a matter of a type of censorship that, you know, seems to be a fact of life in the United States, and it's also a matter of my unwillingness to give payoffs to radio stations to play records.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean literally bribes?
Well, let's just say that there are unusual aspects to the record business that are best left undiscussed.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Frank Zappa's new book is called The Real Frank Zappa Book, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Many of his recordings have been recently reissued on compact disc on Ryko Disc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Chris and Bob Elliott. Chris has created a cast of strange characters on The David Letterman Show, such as the man under the stage. His father, Bob Elliott, is half of the comedy team of Bob and Ray. Chris and Bob Elliott have written a new book called Daddy's Boy, A Son's Shocking Account of Life with a Famous Father. I hope you can join us. This is The Untouchables from Frank Zappa's latest album, Broadway the Hard Way.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the Marquis de Sade, the punk movement, and what they mean to poet and novelist Dennis Cooper. Cooper cites both as influences on his work, which deals with alienation and often brutal sexual encounters. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward listens back to a little music of the 1950s and describes the controversial and inevitable merging of rock and roll and country music. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Good Times, the new memoir by columnist Russell Baker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. According to Radio Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party Politburo today appointed Qiao Xi as party leader. Qiao, considered a hardliner, replaces Zhao Ziyang, who was purged in a party struggle last month. The U.S. government has stepped up its warnings to Americans in Beijing and is now urging them to leave the Chinese capital. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
Today's recommendation that Americans leave the capital is more urgent than the advice offered yesterday, when the State Department simply said Americans in Beijing should stay indoors. The State Department has made contingency plans to charter commercial jumbo jets from U.S. companies, should that become necessary. There are about 1,400 Americans in the Beijing area, besides those attached to the U.S. government. Also today, the Bush administration took steps to allow all Chinese citizens in the United States to remain here past the expiration dates on their visas. Yesterday, the U.S. extended that offer only to Chinese students. The U.S. is also providing refuge for one of China's leading dissidents, Fang Lizhi, an astrophysicist expelled from the Communist Party for his pro-democracy views, has moved into the U.S. Embassy in Beijing for his personal safety. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Thomas Foley today became the 49th Speaker of the House of Representatives. Foley replaces former Speaker Jim Wright, who resigned last week under dozens of charges of ethical misconduct. After his election to the top leadership position, Foley called on both parties to end the months of turmoil that led to Wright's resignation.
I am a proud Democrat, but I appeal specifically to our friends on the Republican side that we should come together and put away bitterness and division and hostility.
But peace is not likely to descend anytime soon. Democrats today criticized an attack on Foley launched by the Republican National Committee. The committee sent out a three-page memo claiming Foley is not the moderate he is reputed to be. The memo, entitled Tom Foley, Out of the Liberal Closet, compares the Washington Democrat to Congressman Barney Frank. Frank is an admitted homosexual and one of the most liberal members of Congress. The Organization of American States is meeting in Washington to hear the report of a special mission to Panama to negotiate a solution to that country's political crisis. Details from NPR's Tom Gelton.
The OAS delegates hoped to persuade Panama's General Manuel Noriega to step down, but they were unsuccessful in that effort, and they did not secure any agreement between the government and the opposition. In the report it presents today, the OAS mission says it needs more time to complete its work. But there's disagreement over how much of an extension should be given the group. The current acting president of Panama, Manuel Solis Palma, is scheduled to leave office on September 1st. If no political agreement is reached before then, the OAS mission notes, a constitutional vacuum will exist in the country. One possible solution, according to OAS sources, is the idea of a transitional coalition government, including both pro- and anti-Noriega elements. Opposition leaders, however, have so far said such an arrangement is unacceptable. They're pressing the OAS to establish a diplomatic quarantine of Panama as a way of boosting the pressure on Noriega. At OAS headquarters in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton.
The environmental group Greenpeace says U.S. and Soviet naval accidents have littered the ocean floor with nuclear weapons and reactors. A Greenpeace report released today used data obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. The report found that more than 2,000 peacetime naval accidents have occurred since 1945, resulting in some 2,800 deaths and the loss of at least 50 nuclear weapons and 9 nuclear reactors. But one of the authors of the study says the number could be higher, since actual figures on the nuclear arsenals of Soviet ships were estimates. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 15 points today to close at 2496.32. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The direction of country music changed in the late 40s when Jimmie Rodgers appropriated Mississippi blues techniques and Bob Wills countrified big band jazz. According to rock and roll historian Ed Ward, that sound faded by the mid-60s when Nashville orchestrated a new sound for country, a sound exemplified by the recordings of Tammy Wynette. And a lot of young country music fans moved over to rock and roll.
When Sun Records owner Sam Phillips made his famous remark that if he could find a white boy with the colored sound and feel, he'd make $1 billion, he really wasn't doing much but expressing the fear that somebody else would find that boy first. Anybody who notices their love of rock and roll leading them to country music will soon discover that in the years before Elvis, as well as afterwards, country music was edging towards what became known as rock and roll. Part of this, of course, was because from the time of Jimmy Rogers and Bob Wills, country had been assimilating black musical influences into its commercial mainstream.
The billy goat said to the billy goat king, come along with me and we'll sway and swing to the billy goat boogie.
Bah, bah.
The billy goat boogie.
Bah, bah.
Everybody's doing the billy goat boogie now.
Right after World War II, the country boogie craze started with performers as unusual as Tennessee Ernie Ford and Red Sovine, whose Billy Goat Boogie we just heard. They recorded songs based around hot licks, usually played by Merle Travis or Joe Mafus or one of the lesser-known Nashville studio hotshots. This, along with Hank Williams' pure piercing blues-influenced songs, was what hip country fans, probably including Elvis himself, listened to in the early 50s. Merrill Moore was a forgotten pioneer of this era, a forerunner of Jerry Lee Lewis, whose piano playing is still revered in Britain. Country boogie was just one aspect of the hot style in 50s country, though. Western swing had been going since Bob Wills helped invent it in the late 20s, and although by this time Wills' star was in eclipse, the torch had been passed to the likes of Hank Thompson and the Brazos Valley Boys.
Hey, Mr. Bartender, please don't be so slow. I got time for one more round and a six-pack to go. Tomorrow morning, Sunday, I'm gonna be feeling low. So please, please, bartender, I want a six-pack to go. I've been drinking all day long, taking in the town. I've done spent my whole paycheck just a honky-tonking round.
Thompson combined Travis-style guitar picking with a hot swing rhythm that sailed right through the whole rock and roll controversy in country music. Oh yes, there was a controversy, too. Don't forget that Elvis was first perceived as a country artist, and so were Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash, who never really did cross over into rock and roll. All over the South, and in the pages of music industry trade magazines, the argument over what was and wasn't acceptable on country radio raged. The problem, of course, was that studio musicians in Nashville loved to play hot licks, and it was hard to hold them back.
I got a hole in my pocket and I can't go to the fair. I got a hole in my pocket and I can't go to the fair. I'm blue 'cause I had a date to meet my baby there.
When Little Jimmy Dickens recorded Hole in My Pocket in 1958, he was looking for another country hit, but it sounds like the guitar player was about 20 years ahead of his time. If Elvis hadn't happened, my money would have been on Johnny Horton, who's best remembered now for his silly historical narratives like Sink the Bismarck and North to Alaska. Those, oddly enough, were hits on rock and roll stations, but he'd slowed down considerably by the time he recorded them.
Get your face all pretty and your hair done right, 'cause we gonna do the town tonight. I'm coming into town and I'm right on time, still got your loving on my mind. I'm coming home, I gotta make some love. I'm coming home, sweet turtle dove. I'm coming home to make sweet love to you.
True, he was no Elvis, but he did record a number of sides that rocked as hard or harder than I'm Coming Home, and he could have wound up a sizable teen idol. The fact was, Elvis wasn't the only country boy who loved black music, nor did country music change from pure Appalachian harmonies to low-down rock and blues overnight. What Elvis and Sam Phillips did was daring and touched by genius. But somebody, somewhere, somehow would have made it happen sooner or later.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Get up about 9 o'clock. From then till dawn, they don't ever stop. If they got change, no one complains. If rock, rock, coal is blowing, for a nickel or a dime, you can have a time where the cats do all the showing. You'll have a ball, join in the call, where rock, rock, coal is blowing. So rock it, rock-ola, rock it, rock-ola. Hands are clapping and feet are tapping to a tune called rock, rock-ola.
This is Fresh Air. Poet and novelist Dennis Cooper says his writing has been influenced by punk rock and his brutal sexual imagery influenced by the books of the Marquis de Sade. In the introduction to a collection of Cooper's poems in the early 80s, Edmund White described Cooper as the poet, critic, and mimic of the blank generation. In a review of Cooper's new novel, Closer, White wrote that Cooper may be one of the few new American writers to have a completely distinct voice. Closer is about a beautiful boy named George and all the men who become sexually obsessed with him. The first chapter is about George and an artist named John.
Students would crowd around him after school and kind of hint how they wouldn't mind modeling when he had a moment. He didn't have time to draw everyone, but being picky meant choosing an artistic goal. John couldn't. He didn't know what he was doing. He wound up selecting the best-looking students because they were fun to deface and pretty easy to fool. He'd just sort of casually say that maybe he was portraying how tortured they were behind their looks, and they'd gasp at his scribbles like they were seeing God or a UFO. One afternoon, a sophomore named George Miles took a seat in John's bedroom and tried not to blink. He'd look cute, maybe even a little too cute, across the school cafeteria, but one-on-one he twitched and trembled so much he made John think of a badly tuned hologram. John tried to draw, but George was already ruined without his help. I'll take a Polaroid, he thought, in case I become a photographer. Reaching for the camera, he happened to notice the bed. No film. Listen, I've got another idea, he said.
Well, I think it's about the closest we'll get to the bed in in any reading. The sex in this book is connected to pain, death, mutilation. Practices people would find extreme and perverted. Do you see this book as social criticism of that kind of sexuality or a manifestation of it?
Well, it certainly isn't criticism of that kind of sexuality. I think it's a reflection of the fears of the characters in terms of connecting with other people, other characters in the book, and the kind of disbelief they have in the idea of love or the idea of a kind of spiritual connection between people, and yet their need to do it.
Do you identify with that yourself?
In a certain way, although the extremity of the acts are just a kind of representation of how things can become, you know, kind of really extreme as an area of information, I guess.
There's a lot of death connected to sex in your novel, and I want to quote a couple of the characters. One of them says, "My ideas about death are beautiful, so I wanted to talk about killing a beautiful person." Someone else says, "After a funeral, I only knew about death from song lyrics and movies, so I don't know how to react except to say wow, although it's a bigger and more serious wow than usual." One kind of death that's missing from your book is death as a result of AIDS. There's really no mention of AIDS in the novel.
No. I'm working on a book now that deals with AIDS in a certain way. But the way that AIDS is represented in the book is that the sex is so terrifying. And I wanted to represent a world that where that major concern wasn't part of it, because the concerns were really these sort of myopic characters who were really shut down people who were trying to connect with each other in this other way that didn't involve things like that, or really a realistic representation of life at all. I mean, there's hardly any women in it. There's all sorts of things that are really unreal about it.
If these characters knew about AIDS, would they have safe sex?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think they're so self-involved. I think they would certainly think about it all the time. It would become part of their fear, and they might very well, but I get the feeling they just don't know what to do.
Do you see your writing as having a pornographic function? Do you want it to be arousing, or do you want it to be disturbing, or both?
Oh, I don't see it as being arousing at all. And in fact, the sex is almost always described through other as a metaphor. I mean, when the George character has sex or is the victim of certain kinds of brutality by the other characters, it's either through his thinking, and he's relating it to Disneyland. I mean, he's trying to imagine the violence being done to him is like the sound of a tree being chopped down and things like that. Or the other people are seeing it in such a distanced way. I don't think it's erotic. It's not at all that. I think it's disturbing, and I'm trying to use the language to kind of mediate in a way so that you're kind of drawn in to studying these acts rather than being like thrown into shock and your mind sort of clicks off at it. So it's disturbing, yeah.
The character in your book that everybody's obsessed with is a very attractive young man, and everybody has a different obsession with him. Have you ever been the pretty boy yourself when you were younger?
No, never. I was always interested in people like the George Miles character, and I've always written about them. And I don't know exactly what that's about. I mean, there's a character, actually, that a person I knew when I was in school on whom the character is based. And actually, the name is the name of this person, but it's not about his life at all, and it's certainly not him. But he was the sort of prototype for a kind of person that fascinates me, a person who is attractive and whose only sense of self-worth is based entirely on his looks, and thereby hasn't doesn't have a sophisticated view on the world, and is really in danger of being exploited by people. And I think that does happen a lot.
Do you feel that you've ever taken advantage of someone young and attractive? You know, you refer to them as being frequently victimized.
I'm more the type who tries to save them, which is equally ridiculous. But I end up being selfish because everyone is selfish. But I'm more the person that feels like they should rescue that person or something.
In reviewing your new novel, Closer, Ed White wrote, "Never has fiction been reduced to such a slim, entirely poetic strain, which is as morally repellent as it is aesthetically seductive." Are you looking for that contradiction?
No, I don't see the work as being morally repellent at all. The point is to look at things. I'm really trying to create something where people confront these things and that it initiates a lot of activity in the reader's brain so they weigh out what this is about and how they feel about these kinds of exploitations and sex and things. I mean, every reaction is perfectly fine, so his reaction is that it's morally repellent. And some people feel that way. In fact, a lot of the reviews have said have used the word repellent and said that yet the writing seduces you into it. And in a way, that's true, but I just don't see this stuff as being repellent. I'm too close to it. I'm too interested in it.
I don't really know much about you personally, but I'd imagine that people who know you from your literature when meeting you would have some pretty strange ideas, you know, pretty wild expectations of what you really like.
That's true. People often think that I'm going to be sort of a vicious, horrible person, but I don't think I am. I think I'm just like really absorbed in the material, and I mean, a lot of people when they get to know me find my interest in it kind of disturbing. But I don't know. I just really feel like that there's something, some kind of answer for myself anyway, and in studying these areas.
You've said that punk music really affected your sensibility. How?
music's always been really important to me, and I've been pretty much informed by that since I was a kid, as much as any other art form. And my ideas and the way I even write is sort of influenced by certain musical ideas and people in popular music. I don't know. I when I was a kid and it was the hippie thing was going on, it just always seemed so fake to me, and I never believed that everyone really loved each other and that it was a whole kind of large humanist world. I just didn't think so. It just seemed like a very terrifying world to me. And then when punk came along, it was more about, you know, that it was a terrible world and that, but you had to fight it. I mean, the whole Sex Pistols idea of like that we're individuals and we can unite through a kind of acceptance of these terrors and a kind of support system that was based on a kind of anarchical idea that, you know, that we were individuals, that it wasn't based on any kind of traditional system, political system or belief system. So just in those ways, I felt very close to that and the way the emotions were expressed in a kind of, the kind of minimalist blank way.
One last question. Do you think of yourself as attractive?
Yeah. I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's a funny question. I try not to think about it.
I ask because you're so kind of drawn to exploring physical beauty in others and how people respond to that physical beauty. So I really wanted to know how you think of yourself.
Oh, not in that way at all. I mean, there's a friend of mine who always says that when I or someone I know see someone attractive, they always say, "Do you want to be that person or do you want to like know that person or get to know?" And it's always, for me, it's a no, whereas other people always want to be, but it's not a desire to be that. It's just a desire to sort of understand it or appreciate it or something.
Uh-huh. So you're not self-conscious about your looks?
Well, no, I'm very self-conscious about everything, but I suppose the looks are involved in it, but
Dennis Cooper, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dennis Cooper's new novel, Closer, is published by Grove Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what are the latest stories out of China that you're following?
This evening, a discussion of the possibility of a confrontation between two of China's field armies, the 27th and the 38th. Also, a report from Tehran on the funeral of Ayatollah Khomeini. Pakistan's Benazir Bhutto arrives in Washington, and the House of Representatives elects a new speaker, Thomas Foley of Washington State. And we'll talk with a waitress at a cafe in Iowa, at a small town in Iowa, where the last stoplight on Interstate 90 still exists. You can get on Interstate 90 from Boston to Seattle and stop at this one traffic light and stop in and have coffee and homemade pie.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. New York Times columnist Russell Baker's memoir, Growing Up, received the 1983 Pulitzer Prize. Growing Up was about Baker's childhood in Baltimore and his early forays into journalism and romance. Now there's a sequel. Book critic John Leonard has a review of The Good Times.
This is the story, Russell Baker tells us, of the good times when a young man, shameless enough to want to make something of himself, could still go to faraway places on the gift of words, even though he was no smarter than anybody else. It's the familiar tone of a Baker column in the New York Times. Friendly, diffident, aw shucks. Picking up where he left off in his marvelous memoir, Growing Up, he'll tell us about his boyhood paper route, his college weekly at Johns Hopkins, his durance vile and giddy rise from police reporter to London bureau chief to White House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, his abduction by James Reston of the Times to cover the State Department, the Senate, and several campaigns for the presidency, his annunciation as observer on that gray paper's even grayer editorial page. So impossibly young, so impossibly charming. He will tell us all this as if talent had nothing to do with it. Just luck, and a mother who nagged him, and a winning way with the surrogate fathers who urged him ever upwards, an inky angel. The story's a lot more complicated, of course. Longtime Russell Baker readers know that a column can turn on them and bite. He has his doubts, and between anecdotes about John Foster Dulles Estes Kefauver, Lyndon Johnson, and Evelyn Waugh, he hints at these doubts. Only a fool, he says, expects the authorities to tell him what the news is. And bad taste was almost always the excuse editors fell back on when they lacked a persuasive reason to suppress news they didn't want to print. And no matter how dull, stupid, unfair, vicious, or mendacious they might be, the utterances of the great were to be reported deadpan, with nary a hint that the speaker might be a dunce, a brute, or habitual liar. For a reporter to question the value of objective journalism was worse than unthinkable. It was subversive. It was revolutionary. Baker knows too many reporters who, for reasons of ego and social advancement, are also players, much too buddy-buddy with the politicians they're supposed to cover, and too many editors and publishers who look the other way in exchange for scoops and invitations to the White House. They're in danger, he says, of demeaning themselves and their papers and betraying their readers by becoming propagandists. It's hard to become a player, he says, and stay in business without ending up contemptible or a columnist. This is the Baker who bites himself, as in the darker stories of Achiever or even a Gogol. While every newspaper he's ever known attracts people who wanted life to be interesting rather than safe, he looks sometimes into his shaving mirror and sees, quote, a man content to wear out his hams sitting in marble corridors waiting for important people to lie to him, a comic strip intellectual, a human pomposity dilating on his constitutional duty, a drum thumper on a demagogue's bandwagon, a member of the claque for this week's fashion. There's not enough of this angry Baker in this otherwise lovely book. He'd have to retire to tell it all. And I'm torn. I wish he'd write forever for the Times. I wish he'd also write at length for the rest of us about everything we should have known but somehow wasn't fit to print.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Good Times by Russell Baker. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, we meet feminist historian Jill Kerr Conway. Her new memoir, The Road from Corrain, describes her coming of age in the rugged Australian outback. Her early studies were conducted through correspondence courses, but later, in America, she became the first woman president of Smith College. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reports on the Boston Early Music Festival and Exhibition, which concluded its week-long activities on Sunday. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts about the interface of computer jargon with everyday language. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Steve Plever. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.